So Margaret Atwood says of her 1940s childhood that there were three things that were off the conversational table in polite society. You weren't supposed to talk about money, religion, or sex. She lived in a house with biologists for parents, so there were plenty of picture books with photos of insects copulating. So her curiosity was sated on that front, leaving the things of God and the things of Caesar as objects for fascination. The religion of Atwood's childhood taught her that money was the root of all evil. Yet another important authority source, Scrooge McDuck comics, with their images of the three McDuck nephews swimming happily in coinage, suggested that money was desirable and fun. So which was it? My own early education about money was just as mixed, if less dramatic. There was the elderly female relative who, when she wanted to give us kids money, would take a $1 bill. Remember, those of you who remember a $1 bill? She would fold it up into this really small wad, and she tucked it between her thumb and her palm, and she would pass it like that to us. And for us kids, that was just the most elegant thing we had ever seen. So we practiced it ourselves. When we got dollar bills, we would fold them all up and go like that. Then there were my parents, who in the spirit of 1970s child raising wanted to be as explicit and conscious as possible. And so I was given an allowance for my chores. And then I was taken to the neighborhood bank to deposit my money and to learn how money works. Did I mention this was the 1970s? Not only did my savings account come with this really cute burgundy fake leather passbook that looked lovely in my orange vinyl purse, or so I thought at the time, but it earned 14% interest. So what I learned was you put money in the bank, you don't have to do chores, and they give you more money. Even at the time, I wondered if this was the lesson I was supposed to be learning. When Vicki Robin and Joe Dominguez wrote Your Money or Your Life, they were very aware of the mixed bag of messages that we receive from our families and from the wider culture about money. On the one hand, there's the biblical message of money as the root of all evil. And then there's Mark Twain saying, the lack of money is the root of all evil. The Beatles sang, money can't buy love. But Spike Milligan says, all I ask is the chance to prove that money can't make me happy. MasterCard tells us that emotional content is priceless. But the material things that bring about the emotional relationship, those can be purchased. As can most of the basic requirements of life. Think about Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Most of those things on the bottom, the important things, if you live in a city, it's an expectation that you will hand over money for food, for housing, for those things that you need to live. Money is so basic in our life, in this culture, that it's like the air we breathe. We may not stop to think about all the ways in which it affects our lives. I just notice it when it feels like I don't have enough. So let's go back in time for a moment. Archaeologists suggest that human beings have been engaging in trade for at least 40,000 years, maybe even for 100,000 years. Evidence of money shows up later. And at first, it's just mixed in with other forms of exchange, such as barter and gift giving. In a barter-based economy, one's family surplus, for example, milk from a goat, is offered in exchange for another family surplus, say, barley. The goat milk and the barley are assigned a value based on each family's need. Their value is relative rather than fixed. In gift-based economies, the value is in the obligation, the sense of a family or a group owing another. Sometimes the value of owing is influenced by social status, as in the potlatch system in the Pacific Northwest Coast First Nations societies, in which those with more status, more resources, are expected to give more and more frequently. And this helps goods move through society. Money often shows up in the first in the form of a trade good, which gets a common value. Obsidian is the raw material for making tools, and in many societies, it was one of the earliest forms of money. In agrarian cultures, grain and cattle were and are a medium of exchange. When people began living together in cities and labor became more specialized, it couldn't be assumed that everyone had access to the cattle or the grain or the stone or whatever was most commonly produced. And so a different form of exchange was needed. In China, Africa, and India, cowrie shells became this medium. In the Mediterranean, a shekel referred both to a specific weight of barley and the equivalent amount of silver, bronze, or copper. At times, money has carried the value within itself, as in the weight of gold coin, for example. But more often, it represented the potential of goods stored somewhere else, maybe in a merchant's warehouse or in government reserves. Money as we use it today has a commonly agreed upon value, which fluctuates according to a commonly agreed upon scale, and this allows it to be used in all sorts of transactions over distance and across time. It's both a medium of exchange and a symbol. The symbolic value of money allows it to be used to estimate the value of anything else. In Charles Williams' poem about England during the time of King Arthur, the Lord Bors returns from London where he finds his Lady Elaine baking bread for the workers. The bread that feeds the laborers was made from the grain that they planted and sowed. Thus, they are paid with the fruits of their labor, and one kind of work is offered in exchange for another. Both the baker and the field laborer give and receive. As Bors says in the poem, none only earn and none only pay. But in London, Bors has learned of a new kind of exchange. The king has built a mint and is making coins. Bors worries about how this money will be used and how it will affect our understanding of the exchange. In the poem, we learn that two of the king's counselors have very different understandings of what's going on. According to the archbishop, money is the symbol of the exchange that Bors knows so well. Money is a symbol of lived experience, and it allows us more opportunities for exchange. Kay, the steward, on the other hand, describes money as the medium of exchange. He speaks of what money can build and the choice that money gives. Money isn't an option. It is the medium of exchange by which everything else is measured. In one view, it is the exchange itself that matters. Field work for baking, labor for labor, goods for goods. Tangible human experiences producing tangible goods. Money, in this sense, is a symbol of our relatedness, and monetary debt is the symbol of the larger debts that undergird our lives, the debts to which we owe our existence. In the other view, the emphasis is placed on the money itself. As it moves back and forth between people, money becomes the thing of ultimate worth, valuable in itself. In spite of the symbols on the coin representing deity and nation, money loses its symbolic value, standing only for itself, separated from the giving and receiving that are at the core of the human experience. So let's come back to today. Imagine a group of friends are gathered round a dinner table. The talk turns to work. A woman mentions her recent promotion. She speaks with pride about her new responsibilities, but her tone becomes dismissive when she mentions the accompanying raise, as if the raise were less important, or somehow not something that she wants to draw attention to. Another dinner table companion stops her, saying, "In our culture, money is a sincere affirmation of value. Appreciate the raise." This opens up a conversation about money and value. The raise that goes with the promotion represents her increasing value to the organization she works for. Why is she uncomfortable? It could be that she's uncomfortable with her own worth. It may also be that she's uncomfortable with the relative valuing of work within her company. Or it could be a discomfort with the culturally constructed scale of values that puts greater emphasis on her work and less than on others at the table. So let's look at the group of people at the table for a moment. Imagine, if you will, that this dinner table includes, in addition to the businesswoman, a high school math teacher, a kindergarten teacher, a CFL football player, and an emergency room nurse. Why does the football player get paid more than the emergency room nurse? Why is the high school math teacher paid more than the kindergarten teacher? Does our understanding of their relative values change if we learn that the kindergarten teacher identified a child with a learning disability and changed the outcome for that child's schooling, thus saving much grief and many societal costs down the road? If money in our culture is a sincere affirmation of value, it tells us some interesting things about what we value. New Zealand economist Marilyn Waring attempted to illustrate the gaps in our system of valuing when she asked about the value of raising children. Why, she asked, is the raising of children not given monetary value? There is most certainly a cost to society when it's not done well. Is there no way of accounting for the value of unpaid household work? On a larger scale, Waring asks why a country's gross domestic product is considered the primary sign of its progress, when the GDP does not include all the factors that make for a successful or happy society. Now, similar questions about social and environmental factors led to the development of the concept of the triple bottom line. The triple bottom line that many of you have probably heard about identifies that there are three bottom lines to business. One is the traditional profit and loss. The other two are the social and environmental results of doing business. How are your people being developed? What sort of impact does your business or organization have on the environment? Triple bottom line accounting attempts to capture the social and environmental results of business practice and reflect more truly the value of the company to human society. If your company makes a lot of money but leaves behind a polluted landscape or exploits workers so that their lives are adversely affected, and government is required to put money into cleaning up a river or creating social programs, perhaps you are operating at a loss, not at a profit. So what is most important? What should we be paying attention to? What do we value? I think this is a useful question to ask whether we're looking at our society, our households, or our congregations. What do we pay attention to? What do we measure? What do we value? We do tend to pay attention to the things that we decide to measure. In Your Money or Your Life, Robin and Dominguez suggest the exercise of writing down every single purchase for a month. My husband and I tried this once. We got horrified at about a week. And then we tried again about a month later. And then we tried again. And we noticed that the act of writing it down did make us more conscious about what we were doing. Now, whether this idea seems natural and easy or insanely difficult and even horrifying depends a little bit on your personality and your temperament. But the principle is this. Money is both a tool and a symbol. Ideas, ideals, and feelings, and images, and words are just abstract concepts until they get put into action. Money is one of the tools we have, in addition to our time, for getting things done. And it's also a symbol. It stands for what we value, for our life energy, for our time. in Sumunk Kidd's book, The Secret Life of Bees, there's a story about a young girl who comes to this house with two older women, and she finally gets to know them well enough to say, "Why is your house bright pink?" when she's talking to the older woman, when your favorite color is blue. The older woman pauses for a second, and she starts to say, "Well, the thing about people," and the young girl says, "I know, the thing about people is they don't know what's important." In August, the older woman pauses for a second and says, "No, you know, we all know what's important. The thing about people is that we know what's important, and we have a hard time doing it sometimes." "I love the color blue," she said. May, her younger sister, who was going through a difficult time, loved the color pink. And she said, "You know, it was the hardest thing in the world for me to let May choose pink as the color of my house." This is what spiritual practices are all about: finding ways to pay attention to what matters so that we are actually more likely to choose it in the busyness of our day-to-day lives. So what would triple bottom line accounting look like in a family or a congregation? How do our choices about money weigh up against our values? So I'd like to pause here for a moment and invite your reflections, your response. How do your choices about money weigh up with your values? What do you do to pay attention to what matters? Jim, I would invite you to take the microphone and pass it around if anybody has anything they want to say.
Thank you, Karen. I just want a reflection with regard to the language, because that's key. And I remember a woman in Quebec spoke about all the aspects of languages, how it influences your life. And I'm not going to get back to you on this one, but I would like to say, how come we pay attention? What is the value of giving money or a monetary value to the attention? And from there, then we go into the triple line of accounting and so on. But this is key. How do we leave our money? And does it really make sense to go in credit? Do we need to go in bankruptcy to know to make a budget? Or do we have to learn this aspect of dealing with what is the value of exchange and what is the meaning of putting a price on somebody's life with regard to their monetary workload and the association. But that's my question would have been the first one. How come we say to pay attention?
So my wife and I both suffer from mental illness, and for us sometimes it's money that makes the difference, and having what gets called a surplus in our budget to be able to do things like order dinner. But it's not a surplus. It's a need, because there are days when my wife and I cannot work the stove. So that's an essential. And I just reflect that money has, I have, as I have grown up and as I have matured, come to the reflection that money is a tool. And sometimes that tool is there to replace legitimately and without any guilt, any flaw, time and effort you don't have.
Yeah, I'd like to add on to that comment. Just a quick point. I'm very excited this concept of money, as I presented a little while back about the guaranteed livable income. It does seem more and more people, not even locally but around the world, are coming to a concept that everyone is deserving of some monetary value outside of whether they are formally employed or not. And it is very exciting to see that in the capitalist world, which many of us have various criticisms of, many of the entrepreneurial capitalists are actually in favor of this because they see that coming into the future there could be more and more joblessness where the creative destruction of the current economic system that we live in is not going to replace all of the jobs that are going to be lost through automation and so on. So it is very exciting to not only be very close to implementation of this system of guaranteed livable income, but also to see a cultural change among most citizens, seeing that everyone in our society has worth, whether or not they are formally employed. So I'm very excited about that.
Yeah, interesting, just thinking about money being a replacement. And I was just talking with the language monitor who's at my school. I teach grade 1-2, and she was like, is there really poverty or like poor people in Canada? She's from the Congo, Brazzaville. And for thinking about what poverty is in a country, some countries in Africa compared to what poverty is in Canada. And I was also in West Africa, in Cote d'Ivoire, where I saw people with no money, yet they had food, they had family, they had connections. And it's interesting to think about how money does replace certain things, maybe as tools. And it's almost a sad way of living that we've given up certain things for that money, and it's almost been thrust upon us as well. It's not through choice sometimes. It's the whole way of living that we have. And to me, I work toward more community where that then you don't have to have that money all the time. That's my hope, at least.
We're getting a little long in time here.
One more.
Okay, one more.
Yeah, in terms of what Mike said, I give money to the food bank and various charities, including the Unitarians. but because I don't have time to help all those organizations, I don't have the time to actually be right there. And so it is a way of sort of exchanging for the time and effort that I don't have. But I also like to choose, local producers, trying to change what we both talking about, which is that we're kind of caught in this mesh of the capitalist system where we have very little choice of moving out of that. Unless you have like an exclusive community somewhere, right, where you're self-sufficient in all your needs, which I saw some in Cambodia with people we might call poor. I know they work very hard, but everybody had a house, everybody had a little boat, everybody had a yard with banana trees and orange trees, etc., and a goat, and so they had enough to survive. In this system, we think we need a huge house, we need a big building, we need cars and all these things, which really is stuff.
Thank you. So I understand that this is the first time that this fellowship has done a canvas in the way you've done it this month. I know that there are some questions that often come up when congregations move to talking about money more explicitly and more openly, which is why I wanted to begin the conversation about money and how we use it. So I hope one of the first questions that's often asked is, why do we talk about money in a Sunday service? I hope that has been addressed. In finding our way through some of these more taboo topics, we get down to talking about what is really important in our lives and what we value. A couple of the other questions that sometimes come up is, won't people feel badly if they can't give more? If we start talking about money, will it make people feel pressured? I always tell people that a canvas is about two things. The first part of it is it's about impact. What impact does the fellowship have in your life? What do you give and what do you receive? How is there an exchange going on between you and the fellowship? And this is about not just money, it's also about time. It's about effort. It's about all the things that you offer and all the things that you receive in return. That's the impact part. The second part is about generosity. And I have to say that some of the most inspiring conversations that I've had about money have been with low-income members of congregations that I have served. People who are quite comfortable talking about money. It's so basic in their lives that they need to have a conversation about it. And when we talk about their pledge, which may be $5 a month, it is the most well thought through pledge that I've had the privilege of hearing about. And so I always talk about Canvas as being an opportunity for generosity. It's an opportunity to think about what you value and how you value it. And I think it's important to say that generosity means giving enough that you notice it. If you don't notice it in your life, if it's a check written and you never think about it again, that's not generosity. If you notice it so much that it keeps you awake at night or anxious during the day, that is not generosity, that's fear. And we don't encourage that. So the idea with a canvas is to find that moment, that place in your heart where what you're giving feels generous. You are extending yourself, but not so much that it causes anxiety. That is not what we want. A pledge is an indication of commitment. It's just a pledge. I myself have been in the place where my life circumstances have changed. So I've gone to the treasurer at the congregation where I was a member and said, my life circumstances have changed. I need to change my pledge. That was totally okay. It's simply an indication that allows us to plan, to think about what we need to do. It's an important commitment. The same as volunteering on a committee, the same as coming to a workshop as, was it 19 people yesterday? 18 or 19 people were here downstairs for, I don't know, it was about 5 hours. It was like 10 till 4 or something like that. And we started talking about the history of the fellowship, and we moved to talk about the strengths and aspirations of the individual people and of the fellowship as a whole. And then we moved, thanks to the wonderful facilitation of Joan Carolyn, we moved into what our actual priorities are for this year. And we, at the very end, we got into action groups. And one of the action groups was about visibility and publicity, and I don't know what they did because I wasn't there. I was in an action group that talked about how we're going to serve our families and our children and how we're going to grow. And one of the plans that we came up with is hosting an event, whether it's a several evenings or a weekend, we're not sure yet. But it will be an event for older children or teens. It might be an OWL program, which is relationships and sexuality. It might be a coming of age program. But it's something that we as a congregation will offer both to our families who are here already and to the community, so that we are engaged and aware and offering something meaningful. And those are the kinds of plans that we are going to be doing this year. Building on the strengths that you already have. You have lots. You have great and interesting people. You have good ideas. What we needed to do was just select two of them to put them into action. One of the gifts of a small congregation is that you have a sense of who you all are. I've been a member of a 400-person congregation. There are people I never met. You have a sense of who you are. That is a strength. You don't have very many people, though, and that's one of the challenges in a small congregation. You may have 60 people, and therefore you have 60 ideas, because we're Unitarians and we all have a really cool idea. But what we need to do to actually move ourselves forward is pick a couple and do them. And that's what we decided to do yesterday. And this is what you are pledging for. So I invite you, if you haven't already, to take this form, which I have just filled out this morning. We're going to be singing a song in a moment. And as we're singing, if you haven't pledged already, I invite you to put down an amount and then fold it in half. And at the end of the service, pass it to our treasurer. Treasurer, would you like to stand up? Thank you, treasurer. Thank you, congregation.